Welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, your audio source for what's going on in the Chicago theater scene. This is the episode for November 5th, 2007, and on this episode we have an interview with playwright Jeffrey Sweet. He talks to Tom Williams about his show, The Court Martial at Fort Devens, which was nominated for a 2007 Jeff Award for Best New Work. Also, of course, we have Chicago's theater news for you. So get ready, Chicago, and let's talk theater.
Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. We have a special guest this week. He is a playwright, screenwriter, lyricist, critic, journalist, teacher, theater historian, and songwriter and director. And he is a playwright who has a play up for a Jeff Award, the Court Martial at Fort Devens, for new work. And say hello, Jeffrey Sweet.
Hello. Delighted to be here.
I'm certainly glad to have you on here. And so you have quite a credentials with writing.
Oh, I've been doing it for a long time. Yeah, no, I knew when I was in grade school I was going to be a writer. My dad was a writer, so I had my first show at a regional theater when I was a senior in college.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's a musical, Book, Music, and Lyrics. Was loosely based on Aristophanes' The Birds. It was called Winging It. And these days, if somebody tried to pull it out, I would consider it to be blackmail because, you know, it's what I wrote when I was 20, you know.
Well, it got you started.
It got me started.
You caught the bug.
It was a lot of fun.
And you are one of the resident playwrights at Victory Gardens Theater.
I am indeed.
And you've had 12 plays produced there.
Is it 12?
That's what my research said. That's from their website.
Okay, so it's 12 or 13, something like that, yeah.
Okay, and Court Martial at Fort Devens, the play, the most recent play you've had done there, I thought was a terrific play. Tell us about that story.
Well, I was researching something else, actually. I was researching a play that I still intend to write someday about the American occupation of Germany, and I was reading the 1945 newspaper, the New York Herald Tribune, and I was reading a story that said continued on page 14, and I cranked to page 14 looking for the rest of the story about American troops coming into Aachen. And instead, what I saw was a little two-paragraph story that said four color girls to be tried for mutiny. I said, hello, what's this about?
Mm.
That's two paragraphs. And it says four young colored whacks are going to be tried for defying the orders of a colonel at Fort Devens, Massachusetts. So I cranked on to find out what happened to them. Oh, they were convicted. What happened from there? And there wasn't an enormous amount in the white press at the time. But I went to the Schomburg Center, which is the black library in New York, and it was front page news there. And I got the rest of the story. I got how Eleanor Roosevelt got involved, how Thurgood Marshall got involved, and how eventually these women, when they had this run-in with a racist colonel, prevailed. They basically ended up being exonerated and forced the colonel to be retired early, and this in 1945.
That is a worthy story. And the production that Victory Gardens did was terrific. I'm sure you saw it.
I was there. I was involved with the production.
Yeah, okay.
That's part of your job as a playwright. Only half the job is putting the words on the paper. The other half is being there and guarding the vision.
I was going to say, and making sure that, what you wrote is what
you
went
on. You have a hand in the casting. And in this, I knew very much that I wanted to work with Velma Austin, and I was thrilled to work.
She was terrific.
She was wonderful, yeah.
And what I liked about it was, these girls weren't social activists. They were just plain ordinary girls who wanted to serve their country, and they were given a promise that they were going to be trained as medical technicians, right?
And the army reneged on the promise, and they that just went against their grain to let that lie. So I was my plays tend to break down into two different kinds of plays. One kind is something that comes out of some aspect of my personal life, not really out of my life, but out of my circle of friends and the people I know. I mean, I had one friend who went nuts in the middle of his divorce when he was standing on line at his bank. He was a guy who had who was coaching a local high school track team, so he had a track a starter's pistol in his pocket. So he was standing on line at his local bank, and he sort of blacked out, and when he came to, he was driving away from the bank with a lot of the bank's money on his front seat. He had robbed his local branch
wow.
of the bank.
True story.
True story. And he realized rather quickly what he had done and thought this was a kind of maybe stupid thing to do, pulled over to the side of the road, hailed a cop and said, "I think I've just done something you might find interesting," and served 6 months for armed robbery. So, I mean, you know, so of course I had to write a play with that character.
And, oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, and then, and I had a friend whose father was blacklisted. And I asked her what she would do if she found herself hired to, she's an actress, if she's found herself hired to be a in a show where the director was somebody who had named names. And she says, "Well, that hasn't happened to me yet." And I said, "Ah, but if." And that's where a play of mine called The Value of Names, which seems to be the one that you can't kill with a steak, got started. That was done originally in 82. They did it at Victory Gardens with Shelley Berman. And Jack Klugman has just finished doing it in the sixth theater he's played it in. He just keeps doing this play over and over and over again.
Geez, I've never seen it. I hope somebody remounts it here in Chicago.
Well, it was darn good. They did it at Gary Marshall's Theater out in L.A. It's up for something called the Ovation Award for best play out there. But Jack just attached himself to this, and he's done it in six theaters. And I'm delighted because people pay to see Jack, but they have to pay me royalties to see
yeah.
it. But it's a play about the blacklist. Ooh. about
Jack's got to bring it here.
Well, I'm sure he'd be delighted to if somebody invited him.
It would be an audience pleaser because there are those who remember the play, I'm sure. What year was it done?
Oh, when it was done here, it was 83 with Shelley Berman. Okay. Shelley and Bern Piven.
Wow.
Yeah, that was 83. It did nicely. It ran 6 months here. But that one just keeps getting done. But that's another one that came sort of out of personal experience or connections with the people I knew. And the other ones tend to be something that I stumble across historically or politically that I just say, I've got to tell that story. So I can't say that, you know, doing a court martial at Fort Devens, you know, I've never been black. I've never been in the army. I've never been a girl. And I wasn't alive in 1945.
Well, that gave you the credentials to do it.
Well,
you know, I mean, you had enough detachment, and you're an excellent researcher. Some of the history plays that I've seen that you've done.
Well, I got my hands on the transcripts of the court martial, and a lot of the court martial scene, in fact, came directly out of the transcript. I said, "Well, yikes, I'd be stupid to pass this by."
Yeah,
because this is just a great scene, and the story is a great story. I fictionalized it lightly. I didn't want to have such a big cast play that it would be difficult to mount. So instead of four young women, there were two young women. But virtually everything that happened in the play happened in reality, and it's pretty close to the truth. There's more to the story. If somebody ever wanted to make a movie, there's a lot of other stuff that could be brought in about what was going on in Boston at the time.
And since you've written a few screenplays, I'm sure you would adapt it for
right? I'd be delighted to adapt it as a screenplay. But as I say, I alternate between stuff that has some kind of personal connection and stuff that has some historical or political connection. I like to mix it up.
Well, I remember seeing your Berlin 45 a couple of years back. I think it was 2006.
Yeah.
And that was excellent, about the Russians taking over in Berlin at the end of the war.
But that came out of me researching the same bloody play. I was still trying to do the American occupation of Germany. I got deflected by reading about the women in Berlin as the Russians came in, and I read this sensational anonymous memoir. And although what I wrote wasn't based on that memoir, the ethical questions that this woman came up with, I just thought this was haunting stuff. So,
yeah, like who was responsible for what?
Yeah, and how good people who were stuck in Germany and hated Hitler, but you know were trying to survive, managed to keep alive and try to keep some semblance of honor intact in the middle of their country going to hell around them and doing horrible things. I'm not saying that I wrote this because George Bush was president, but it certainly
okay. Let's see, but you also dealt with the guilt of the Russian officer for some of the things that they did you know, in to win the war and to sort of punish Germany.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Russian officer in particular was an engineer who had in fact been thrown into one of the camps by Stalin. Stalin was always thinking that the engineers were plotting against him or were going to sabotage him. And the engineers were, the you know, early on, they were like great heroes of the revolution. And then Stalin started seeing that what he wanted and what the engineers recommended turned out to be different things. So he won the argument the way he usually did by, you know, having people exterminated.
If I remember correctly, it had to do with him building a dam.
Oh, yes.
And he was going to build it right, and then...
He was going to build it whether the engineers recommended it or not. And the great engineer, Russian engineer, was a guy named Peter Palchinsky. And Palchinsky said, if you build the dam here, you will have to clear so much land and remove so many farmers that the land that you're going to clear and the wheat that you're going to get rid of, you could burn that wheat and get more energy than you're going to get from the dam that you're going to build. And Stalin didn't like this, so he had Palchinsky shot. And they flooded this huge area. All these farmers had their farms, taken away from them, and a lot of them ended up working on the dam where the building conditions were inhumane, and thousands of them died building this bloody dam. So, and it ended up being the biggest dam in the world, but not much use, really, ultimately.
Well, what I liked about Berlin 45 and the other one that I want you to talk about, the action against Saul Schulman. That was pretty strong.
Oh, these are all the historical plays, yeah.
Yeah, and that you talk about the history and these themes, but you make it real in terms of people, and you make it a dramatic story that can hold our interest on the stage.
Well, my way in always is I'm interested in the people first and the history second. I've always was taken by a person who is within a historical context, not saying, oh, I want to do something about, you know, post-war Germany, or, oh, I want to do something about, the Pullman strike or something like that. What I was always interested in was, oh, this person's in an interesting situation. Oh, they're in this situation because of the historical context. So it was always through individuals in an interesting ethical dilemma that I get to the history rather than saying, oh, I'm going to do the history. Now let me pick a straw figure to represent this force or that force.
And the other thing I like, particularly in Berlin 45, I had read quite a few books about that era and the American occupation and the Russians and so forth. Leon Uris has a book, there's several of them, that your history is very accurate, so that you can be trusted to tell a story and the history. In other words, there's a way of teaching history to people, like to college kids and so forth, that your history is accurate, so even if you fictionalize a few things with the characters, the main part of it is it's not propaganda. It isn't the like JFK and a few of those movies where it's really propaganda sold as history. You don't do that.
No, I think that since most people get their history from entertainment, it's the people who are writing plays and movies on historical themes have a responsibility to get the big things right. To do the facts as far as they're known and not contradict established and provable facts.
I couldn't agree with you more, and that certainly gives a lot of credibility, because your plays could be assignments for a high school or a college course on history.
Well, I'll take that as a compliment, but it makes them sound dry and dusty.
No, but I mean to make it also rather interesting too.
Mostly, I just thought this is a darn interesting situation for these people to be in, and I wanted to write about the dilemma of people living in difficult times. So that's where that came.
Well, tell us about the Saul Schulman play, because I only remember that vaguely.
Well, that was a friend of mine named David Van Bima wrote an article about a guy named I'm forgetting his first name, but it was Tannenbaum. Who was a beloved member of the Jewish community in Brooklyn. He was a member of an Orthodox group, gave money to the Simon Wiesenthal Center and all the rest of this. And he gave a paroches, which is a kind of ceremonial curtain, to a synagogue. And when you do this, you can sign it. You can say, you know, in memory of my relative, signed, and so forth. And somebody recognized the name in the paroches, and it was a guy who'd been in a camp with him. And it turned out that Tannenbaum had indeed been in a camp, but he had been a capo. That is to say, he'd been placed by the Nazis in authority over fellow Jews, and he had flipped out and beaten and perhaps killed some of his fellow Jews in this position.
Guilt later, but they had to cooperate.
Yes, yeah, so some of the capos use their positions to shield people and to protect people and so forth. And to some degree, Tannenbaum did that too, but he'd lost everybody, all of his family. And at a certain point, he simply flipped out and went nuts and took some of his rage against the world out on the people who were under him. And there were people who were crippled and murdered, who died because of him. Well, he regained, as far as I can tell, regained his sanity. Conveniently forgot most of this stuff, came to the United States, falsifying his information when he got into the country, became a pillar of the community, and here he was until somebody recognized him and brought a complaint to the Office of Special Investigations, the OSI, and it was the only case in which the OSI went after a World War II war criminal who was Jewish.
And a camp inmate.
Yeah, but he was, the idea of a Jew capable of doing evil things to a fellow Jew is part of what is disturbing and chilling about this.
Yes.
Now, at the same time that I had read my friend David Van Bima's article about this guy, I saw a documentary called Kaddish, which was about a young man whose father was a survivor of the camps and who has devoted himself to activist Jewish causes, particularly as related to what was going on in the Soviet Union at the time. And he's obsessive about this, and he has nightmares about the Nazis coming after him every night. And then midway through the filming of this documentary, his father died, and he felt that he had to not only do his own efforts, but he had to also do extra effort to compensate for the death of his father. And you thought he was going to go nuts on screen.
Wow.
And I thought, okay, what if this father, Tannenbaum, had that son? And that's where the play came from. So I wrote it and I fictionalized, but all the details in that are consistent with, in terms of the public record, are consistent with the procedures and the documents.
Just to refresh our memory, did he get convicted and get deported or what?
What happened in real life was, as they were preparing for the case, he had a stroke and they said he could not participate meaningfully in his own defense. So they came to a settlement. And he was stripped of his citizenship, but he was allowed to stay in the country, and he spent the rest of his life in a nursing home on Long Island. So that, in fact, is what happens in the play, but also what happens in the play. The play is more about the son in the play, about this guy who has this one idea of his father and then gradually begins to understand that his father has a much more complex past, and it changes this guy's sense of himself, and he can no longer live with that identity. So it's the closest thing to a tragedy I've attempted to write. The interesting thing to me is the play was done in New York, and at one performance afterwards, somebody comes up to shake my hand and congratulate me on the play, but to say he has a few things he wanted to tell me, and it was Tannenbaum's son.
Wow.
He said, you got it mostly right, he said, but I think you should have had more about what my dad suffered through and how viciously he was treated that it unleashed this stuff in him. So, obviously, when he came up to me and said, I'm Sonny Tannenbaum, I went, oh, is he going to punch me or what?
I was going to say, yeah, that must have shook you a little bit.
That's happened a couple of times. I wrote a play many years ago about George Pullman. The founder of the town,
sure,
of Pullman and the Pullman strike and
Chicago
all that.
Chicago people, yeah.
Yeah. And after one of the performances, I was told that I think it was Pullman's great-grandson and his kids were there. I thought, oh, well, I wonder what he's going to say. Because it's not exactly a completely flattering portrait of Pullman. He's sort of pig-headed, and he ends up causing this strike, and there are a lot of deaths that happened because of the strike and so forth. But he came up to me and says, he says, you painted him nicer than they told us he was.
Well, that's reassuring.
So I said, oh, well, okay. I saw him as sort of a tragic figure. But
that's also testimony, I think, to your to you doing your homework and, doing your history.
Well, my dad was a history major. He had a couple of degrees in history, and he was very helpful to me in terms of doing some of the research. And my brother at the time was working on Capitol Hill in Washington, and he managed to smuggle out of the Library of Congress copies of the Federal Strike Commission. So I got the testimony of all my primary characters in front of the Federal Strike Commission, so I could find out what their rationales were and how they spoke, and it was a tremendously useful stuff.
Yeah, I could imagine that.
That was a lot of fun. But I'm not trying to give Sidney Kingsley competition. I'm not trying to write only historical or political plays. I like to alternate. I like to mix it up. You know, a play like Bluff, for instance, has got no historical or political content whatsoever.
I'm not familiar with that. Tell us about Bluff.
Bluff was about this young woman and this guy that she gets involved with in contemporary New York. And they move in together, and they're having this swell time. And then her stepfather shows up, and her stepfather is a salesman, sells dental supplies. And he also has a tendency. What kind of language can I use in this? Can I use any?
Well, I would just infer to it. We imply, try and keep right. it family friendly.
All right, family friendly. Let's say that he's doing things with women he's not married to.
Okay.
And he's this woman's stepfather, and she becomes aware that when he's out of town, he's misbehaving. And she confronts him with this, and she says, basically, you know, if you don't clean up your act, I'm going to tell mom, and you live in California, community property will kick in, your lifestyle is going to take a deep dive into the deep south there, you know. And he says, well, you know, let's follow this through. What happens if you tell your mom? You're right. She will boot me out of my butt. And so who's going to keep an eye on your mom? And we gradually begin to realize that the mom is an alcoholic and the father is the one who's kept her alive for the last 15 or 20 years. And if he gets booted out, the daughter is going to be responsible for the mom.
Ooh.
And so
it really gets complicated.
And she begins to realize that her freedom has been purchased by this guy being there, taking on those responsibilities for the mother. That in a sense the mother had abandoned him by going into drink years ago, and that he's turned into kind of the hero of the play, and this galls her. Well, her boyfriend, and this has repercussions on her boyfriend. The boyfriend was played by John Cryer, who now is known as one of the stars of Two and a Half Men.
Right, yeah. He's
and I used to babysit him.
Oh, okay.
You know, his mother is Gretchen Cryer, who wrote "I'm Taking My Act," putting my act together and taking it on the road, and played it here in Chicago for a while. And I used to babysit him, so I wrote this play, and I gave him a call. I said, "I got a play for you." He says, "Well, now tell me, why should I do this play?" And I said, "I let you stay up to 9:30." He says, "Well, that's a reason." He came and did it. And
okay.
A couple seasons later, he had Two and a Half Men. CBS should be very grateful to me because people do my plays and they do hit TV series. Because
so you're the lucky charm.
Well, Bill Peterson did Flyovers, and of course, a couple years after Flyovers, CSI saved the network. So between, I think that what is it? CSI and CSI is the top-rated drama,
right.
And Two and a Half Men is the top-rated.
And you're right; it did save the network.
Yeah,
you're absolutely right.
To the point where they spun it off to several other shows.
Yeah,
so.
They could find anyone in the world. They should have those people get Bin Laden and all. I mean, one little thread of evidence and
yes,
they can solve anything.
It's incredibly realistic. So I was very lucky. One year I had Bill Peterson, and the next year I had John Cryer, and they were both wonderful to work with and wonderful people. You know, so that's the thrill of doing work on this scale.
Well, we certainly can't, in this interview, we certainly have to mention Victory Gardens and Dennis Zajac, because he certainly gave you a major boost up, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. No, he's years and years ago, I had a small play that was done off Broadway in New York, and Joyce Sloan had already introduced me to Dennis, saying, you know, maybe Joyce is at Second City, and I wrote a book about Second City. And she read the bio on the book and said, oh, you're a playwright? And I said, yes. And she says, well, I'm sending you over to Dennis Zajac, and I'll tell him to be nice to you. So I got on the number 22 bus, got off, and there was it. Dennis says, Joyce says I should be nice to you if you got something. And I gave him a play called Porch. And he sort of sat on it for a while. And in the meantime, it was done off Broadway in New York, where it got a terrific review out of a very mean critic in the New York Times.
Well, anytime you get a good review from a mean critic, that says a lot. Yes.
Richard Eder, who was a very good critic, but he only lasted for a year at the Times because he was perceived as being too mean.
Yeah, that's what I remember hearing that.
Yeah, he's now a book critic, and he won the Pulitzer Prize for book criticism. But I called up Dennis and I said, the New York Times gave us a good review. How'd you like to put the show on? So we put it on in the second stage. It opened in the middle of the blizzard of, I think it was 78.
Oh, that was a bad one.
And I was flying into town to see a rehearsal and to see the opening. And I looked down, and there was nothing but there were 10-foot tall snow drifts. It would snow and freeze and melt and freeze, and it just would. It got to 10-foot tall, and I looked around, and I thought, who's going to go outdoors in weather like this? Then I went to the rehearsal, and it was just about perfect. So the production was just wonderful. Sonia Lansner, who ended up winning a Jeff for that performance, and Tom Eula made his directing debut on that, and Raoul Johnson was. It was a wonderful production.
Yeah.
I thought, well, it's a lovely production. Too bad nobody's going to see it. Who's going to go out in this weather? And then Richard Christensen came and just gave the show this extraordinary notice, and we sold out in 15 seconds. And
wow.
I thought, yikes, Chicagoans are hardy. You know, my God, they're going to fight this weather to come see a play by somebody they've never heard of. That's swell.
Yeah, that's got to be a motivator.
And Dennis said, "Okay, what's the next one?" So I gave him my next one. We put it on. It didn't do well. But he said, "Okay, what's the next one?" I thought, "Oh, he's dedicated to the writer, not just to the play."
Yeah, that's terrific. Some people say, "Well, you know, if he really likes a playwright, he'll put on even their not so great stuff." But I respect that because that's loyalty.
I think it's what you need to do in order to learn how. Well, the third one was a big hit for them. It was called Ties, and it ran in at their old space near Wrigley Field, and they didn't want to close it down because it was making money, so they needed to find a new space. So they rented a space in the Body Politic building, and then they moved there.
Yeah, that's right. They did. Now called the Greenhouse. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, my play was the first play the Victory Gardens did in the Greenhouse, and then eventually Victory Gardens bought the whole building. But and we did a TV version of it for WTTW back here when TTW was still doing TV versions of plays, and it was a big success for them. So he said, "What's next?"
You know, we've got to get WTTW to start replaying those. They have a number of those.
Well, I wish they would because there's and also WMAQ shot some stuff too. There's an incredibly valuable tape sitting somewhere, a much cleaned up version of Steppenwolf's Say Goodnight Gracie with Malkovich and Joan Allen. And,
I'd love to see that.
Yeah, no, that's there. And the company that Julia Louis-Dreyfus was in with her husband Brad, that they've got tape on that. There's all this wonderful stuff. But
thanks for the clue. I'll start looking into that.
WTTW has got this attitude, which I disagree with. They say, "Well, theater doesn't translate to TV, and so we're not going to cover it." I mean, so they don't do TV versions of plays here. This is the most active theater town on some level in the country.
Oh yeah, I think we are. Absolutely.
And they have not documented it. I think they've abrogated their responsibility to document the history of Chicago theater. In London, you have a hit show in London, and it gets transferred to TV or transferred to BBC Radio.
I'll tell you, I'm looking into it. The economics of it are going to be tough, royalties and so forth. But we're looking into it with all these young producers around that know video, and the equipment is inexpensive today. And the colleges are cranking out these kids that are technically excellent.
And there are some plays, more realistic plays, you can actually shoot on location. The one that we did, Ties, was shot on a college campus, so it was done realistically, and it could be done as a conventional TV play.
But even, I think, Great Performances has proved that even when you take, like, a big musical, and you shoot it with enough cameras, and it's still played to the audience, because you can see them really projecting, that it still works. It's kind of a new art form.
It depends on which shows you're doing, and you have to pick your properties really well. Things that are very presentational or have bravura, big performances tend to work very well when you're just shooting them in front of the audience. Otherwise, you have to go into a studio and recreate them as studio pieces.
Yeah. I tend to, especially dramas, we'll say plays that are people talking to one another versus musicals. Yeah, I agree. I think scenery and it makes a big difference. Yeah,
TTW. I once was complaining to somebody there. I said, you've got this active theater scene here. Why isn't this being really actively documented? Why aren't you doing 3 or 4 TV versions of productions a year? And they said we decided as a matter of policy that it just didn't look very good, so we weren't going to do it. I said, you're missing one of the big Chicago stories, which is what's happening in
this
town.
I see 20 or 30, at least 20 or 30 world premieres a year here.
Yeah.
And I'd say 8 or 10 of them are just outstanding, and have a life of their own. You see them produced other places. You just know they're going to they're going to go somewhere. Like your both your plays that I recently saw, Berlin 45 and the Court Martial.
Well, Court Martial is going to get done around partially because it's the first play that I've written which has no curse words and which has got a lot of parts for black actors, particularly young black women, of which there aren't very many plays. Once you've done For Colored Girls, the Entezaki Shange piece, it's very difficult to find.
And there's some parts in August Wilson plays, but other than that, you're right. It's few and far between.
Yeah, half the cast is more than half the cast is women.
Well, let's be in the interest of time here. We've got a few minutes left. Let's talk about the book you have coming out. Tell us about that.
Oh, it's an anthology of nine of the plays, plus a few sketches. So it's most of the plays were pieces that started at Victory Gardens, although The Value of Names actually officially premiered at the Arena, at the Actors Theater of Louisville, and then a different production was done at Victory Gardens. And American Enterprise was one of the plays that was done at the Organic Theater in their old space. But the rest of the plays, most of the plays played at Victory Gardens either had their World or Chicago premieres at Victory Gardens.
Okay, and the title of the piece?
The Value of Names and Other Plays by Jeffrey Sweet.
Okay, and it'll be coming out, who's publishing?
In June, it's coming out in June from Northwestern University Press. They, I owe a thanks to Gary Houston, who said, you know, you should have an anthology published. And I said, well, nobody's asked me. He says, oh, well, I'm friends with somebody at Northwestern University Press, called up and proposed it. And they said, would you be interested? I said, sure. They said, well, send over the manuscript and we'll have a blind reader evaluate it. And I thought, oh, okay. So they sent it out to their blind reader. This is, say, somebody...
Some grad student.
Well, somebody I didn't know. Yeah. And this person wrote and said, this book must be... must be published, and what's more, I'll write the introduction. It turned out it was Richard Christensen. So,
who you just happen to know. Isn't that the stars lining up for you?
I'm delighted and very flattered because he liked most of the plays when they were produced. So, the idea that he's going to write an introduction, and also he's probably he and Jonathan Abarbanel are probably the two people in town who have seen virtually everything that I've done in town, and they would be the two people who would be qualified to write an overview.
So that's terrific. Jonathan would be nice to hear that. Be glad to hear that.
Well, I have a high opinion of Jonathan as well. But it's very gratifying. Although it represents about 30 years of work, and I'm looking and thinking, okay, that's 30 years of work. Will I live long enough to come up with volume two?
You know? Well, you got to start cranking, right?
I suppose I'm working on a new one,
but it's got to be flattering to have one out like that.
Oh, it's enormously flattering. It's a little bit like an acknowledgement that the stuff is of sufficient consequence to be put into permanent form. Well, I would recommend, if you don't mind going back to a book that came out in 1978, my book on Second City, Something Wonderful Right Away, which...
I don't know enough about Second City. Say it again, the title?
It's called Something Wonderful Right Away, and it's interviews with all the early people, Mike Nichols, Paul Sills, Barbara Harris, Alan Arkin, Alan Alda, Joan Rivers, Robert Klein, David Steinberg, Gilda Radner.
Wow.
It's quite a group of people.
Yeah.
And I was told by a few people that they used it to build Chicago theaters. Charna Halperin told me that it's what inspired her to start I.O. And Mick Napier apparently read it when he was in college and said, when I graduate, I'm going to Chicago and starting a theater. So he starred the Annoyance and was directing it.
Well, that's flattering.
It's very nice. I feel like an illegitimate father, shall we say? They told me that this book was useful to them. But
I'll have to get a hold of that and read it and get caught up on the history. It's one of the missions that we like to do with these podcasts is to make an audio record of significant people and events in Chicago theater.
Well, Richard Christensen wrote an article in which he said something that hadn't occurred to me. He said that the Chicago theater boom is largely an explosion out of Second City. He says Victory Gardens was founded by people, largely by people who were Second City alum. Steppenwolf looked at Second City and said, well, if unknown Chicagoans can build one theater, unknown Chicagoans can build two theaters. If you look around town in one way or another, Second City has had an influence either by example or spinning off this actor or that writer or that director.
That's true. That's true. There is a lot of just like there is to Bill Plincy and Candlelight for musical, for the musical, and everyone got seemed to have gotten their start there.
But that was when the 25th anniversary of Second City came out. Christensen was still writing for the Sunday Art Supplement for a paper that's no longer with us, I think. But and he traced the history of Chicago theater and the Chicago theater renaissance to Second City. He said that without Second City, it wouldn't have happened here. So I'm you know, that wasn't my intention when I wrote the book. My intention was, gee, I want to talk to Mike Nichols. Why on earth would he want to talk to me? Gee, I want to meet Barbara Harris. Why would she want to talk to me? And I thought it was going to be a very short project, that I was going to talk to 10 celebrities and type them up, and that would be it. And it ended up taking more than 3 years, and the book ended up being about other things than I realized when I started. It just got deeper and more involved and more interesting. And to a large degree, it's about the relationship between the theater and the community, and the idea of Second City as being, as Avery Schreiber used to call it, an urban folk theater, that whatever was going on in society would have an expression very quickly on stage, which was particularly apparent during the 1968 Chicago
convention. That's when I used to go there. That's true. Whatever was happening, it could be happening that day, and they'd have it on the stage that evening.
And that's part of what is valuable about that form, is that it's like an editorial cartoon. It's not the long viewed measured response to history. It's an instant response to what's going on, and giving voice to the frustration or the outrage or the amusement of the audience by giving it instant representation on stage.
Wow, this has been great.
Well, it's great fun.
And we have gone slightly over what we normally do, but that's okay. It's been very interesting. And Jeffrey Sweet, I wish you good luck today at the Jeff Awards.
I will need plenty of it.
but as they say, it's an honor to be nominated.
It's an honor to be nominated, and I know I'm going to see lots of friends. And
it will be fun.
We'll count each other's gray hairs.
Thank you. And folks, thank you for listening. And remember, go see a play this week.
Hello, Chicago, and welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Mote, bringing you the theater news for the week of November 5th, 2007. Last Monday, October 29th, the Joseph Jefferson Awards Committee presented 32 Jeff Awards at the North Shore Center for the Performing Arts in Skokie. They honored 122 nominees from Equity Theatrical Productions here in Chicago, and it was a star-studded gala hosted by Mark David Kaplan and Renee Matthews. In the play category, Steppenwolf led all play recipients with 6 awards for its August Osage County. The awards included Best Production for a Play, Best Ensemble, Principal Actress, Director, Scenic Designer, and Best New Work for a Play. However, since August Osage County was starting previews the following night on Broadway, nobody was there to accept, which made the ceremony a little bit quicker than anticipated. Also in the plays category, the Goodman Theatre collected 3 awards for its Mirror of the Invisible World, which was indeed a very successful show for the Goodman Theatre. In the musical category, Porchlight Music Theatre led with 4 awards for its Ragtime the Musical. These awards included Best Production as a Musical, Best Director, Music Director, and Supporting Actor. Marriott Theatre took home 3 awards for its The All-Night Strut, which of course did very well for the Marriott also. Other highlights of the evening include a special award that went to Jackie Taylor, Black Ensemble Theatre founder. She received a special award for her lifetime of dedicated leadership in celebrating the contributions of African Americans through theatre. Another highlight was Dan Proctor, who was shot in the head back in 2005. He got up on the stage and proclaimed, "I'm back," to thunderous applause. And on another high note, Lance Baker's mom called on his cell phone to say hi to everybody when he accepted the award. What a night! The awards committee sent judges to the opening nights of 123 equity productions by 49 producing organizations. From all of these openings, 93 of those became Jeff recommended. The producing organization that walked away with the most awards was Steppenwolf Theater Company with 6, Porchlight Music Theater Chicago went home with 5, and the Goodman and Marriott Theaters went home with 4. For a complete list of the recipients and more detail about the events of the night, be sure to click on over to Talk Theater in Chicago's Theater News section. The producers playing at the Marriott Theater will be closing 1 week earlier than they had planned. Instead of closing on December 2nd, the show will now be closing on November 25th. It is certainly not the norm for the Marriott to be ending a show early, but don't worry, however. This was not due to weak ticket sales, but the decision is said to be due to technical reasons regarding some upcoming productions, meaning Les Mis and Little Women. Stay tuned to Talk Theater in Chicago for more information. Well, thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. We have come to the end of the news, but before I let you go, it's time for your Shakespeare Quote of the Week. The following quote comes from Henry VIII, Act 2, Scene 3. A golden sorrow. That brings us to the end of another Newsweek. Remember, you can find us here every Monday with new episodes just for you. So, until then, that is the theater news from Talk Theater in Chicago. And I'm your host, Dustin Moat. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. I would like to thank Jeffrey Sweet for giving us the honor of interviewing him this week. I would also like to thank Tom Williams and Mark Meyer. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. And also, I would like to thank you, our listening audience. Remember, we are here every Monday with a new episode ready for your listening pleasure. So, until next Monday, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you, Chicago, to keep talking theater.